5th anniversary of the founding of these lectures in February of 1916. You're very welcome to join the Institute for the remainder of this year. The series will go on till the end of April. Tonight our lecturer is Dr. Colin Cray, who comes to us from Oxford. Dr. Cray was educated at Magdalen College in Greats, which is the name given to the subject comprising Greek and Latin and the history and philosophy of the ancient world. He received his doctorate there in 1953. He very quickly proved himself to be an outstanding scholar in classical coins, which was recognized by his appointment as assistant keeper and later keeper of the Heberden Coin Room at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, a position which he holds today. He's a fellow of Wolfson College of Oxford, which is a graduate college, and he's a fellow of the British Academy. His list of publications and technical journals on the coinage of Greece and Rome and the ancient world extends over 3 pages. And he is particularly well known for his work dealing with a chemical analysis of coins to determine their dating. But apart from that technical field, his interest touches on many related fields as well: language, fine arts, history, and archaeology. He has made this impressive erudition available to laymen through several popular works, including Archaic and Classical Greek Coins and Greek Coins. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Colin Cray to speak on the coinage of Athens and the ancient world. Dr. Cray.
Are you going to stay there?
You
won't get a very good view of the slide.
All right.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, can I just be assured that my words are reaching the back of the hall through this instrument? That does seem to be okay. Mr. President, I'm delighted to learn from you a few minutes ago that we both share Magdalen College, Oxford, as our part of our education. And I was also pleased to hear that the first president of Wolfson College, Sir Isaiah Berlin, for whom I have a great affection, also has been one of my predecessors in this hall. I'm told that this is the Vancouver Institute's 65th year of lectures, but I really wonder whether I can claim that this is the first lecture on the subject of Greek coinage. I imagine that I can't have had very many predecessors. While I think anyone can understand the attraction of collecting Greek coins for their beauty, or for their interest, or for the immediate contact they provide with the ancient world, it often comes as a surprise to learn that ancient coins are a primary source of information about the ancient world. We don't think of our own coins in this way. We're too concerned with using them. But ancient coins do give us a vast amount of information about religion, politics, economics, iconography, portraiture, personal names, art, and many other spheres of antiquity. And very often, they are the only source of information for such matters. Now, I must just now get used to the electronics here. If I turn off that, and that, and that, and that. Now, let's see what happens. Yes. We should turn off that one too, I think, yes. Fine. I have, however, chosen to speak to you tonight about the coinage of Athens, not because we are short of information about Athens. On the contrary, we are exceptionally well informed, and it's easy enough to forget the extent to which the history of ancient Greece, as it has come down to us, is really just the history of Athens. We have no difficulty in thinking of famous Athenians, Plato, Pericles, Socrates, Euripides, Phidias, Demosthenes, and many others come easily to mind. But what about famous Corinthians? It's difficult even to begin a list at all. For this very reason, that we know so much more about Athens than about other places, we can fit Athenian coinage into a context in a way that's rarely possible anywhere else. Moreover, the coinage of Athens is remarkable in the Greek world, not perhaps for its beauty, but for its volume and its duration. For this, there may be a number of reasons, but the principal one certainly is that, unlike most other Greek cities, Athens had the good fortune to have her own source of silver in her own territory in the silver mines of Laurium. These lay to the southeast of Attica, just behind the famous temple of Sunium, which some of you may have visited. This wealth made Athens simply a rich city and one able to construct expensive buildings, such as the famous little monument of Lysicrates, erected to commemorate a victory in the theatre. It also meant that Athens had an ample supply of silver coin, which she could export either to buy necessities or luxuries. But these coins did something more, for they carried knowledge of Athenian coinage and sometimes of the knowledge of coinage itself to areas which were as yet unfamiliar with the use of coinage. Coinage first appears in Asia Minor in the later 7th century BC. It was there coined in electrum, a natural alloy of gold and silver. But only later did the practice of coinage pass to mainland Greece, where the locally available metal, pure silver, was used. At Athens, we can't trace coinage further back than about the middle of the 6th century. And there it begins in a small local coinage, which you see on the screen, of which the characteristics are that the types, the main designs, changed every few years. There are about a dozen such main designs, of which only three are on the screen. I can put one more on the screen. I'm sorry, that one's got the wrong way round, but you will see that this, if you tilt your heads to the left, you will appreciate that this is the wrong end of a horse. Now, why the wrong end of a horse should be used as a coin type, I cannot explain, but it was. These coins are known as Wappenmünzen. This is a traditional name, a German name, meaning heraldic coins. because at one time they were thought to be the badges of principal aristocratic Athenian families in power from time to time, hence Wappenmünzen heraldic coins. But this idea has usually been abandoned now, and it's thought that most of these designs had some relation to the cult of Athena and were changed every few years. But it was a minor local coinage. There is nothing explicitly Athenian about it, though there are a number of more or less technical arguments which lead one to believe that this is an Athenian coinage rather than somewhere else. This coinage perhaps lasted for 40, 50 years, say from about 560 to 520. Dates at this early period are still much discussed, and precision within 10 or even in some cases 20 or more years is not yet attainable. We can certainly associate this early coinage with the tyrants of Athens, probably with Hippias rather perhaps than his more famous father Pisistratus. You will see that the coinage at this stage is uniface, the reverse of the coin being occupied only by a punch designed to drive the metal down into the depths of the obverse die. Towards the end of this series, indeed, reverse types did appear, and they became constant thereafter. Sometime in the reign of Hippias, then, probably about 520, a major change took place in Athenian coinage, and the coins, as we shall see from their reverse type, were known as owls. This is an owl photographed in Athens, obviously in modern times, and I'm no expert on birds, but I assume it's much the same sort of owl as we shall see repeatedly on the reverse of the Athenian coinage. Now, once we get on to the owl coinage of Athens, we reach themes on the coinage which were to remain constant for about 500 years. In other words, until the very end of Athenian coinage. Naturally, the details do not remain the same. There is stylistic development. But the theme of an Athena head on the obverse, an owl on the reverse, does remain constant right the way through. And we see at once that we are with a coinage which is totally different from that which went before. It is quite explicit about its origin. Not only the local goddess Athena, her owl, and there you will see it much more clearly on future slides, the name of Athens, the three letters Alpha, Theta, Epsilon, standing for Athenion of the Athenians, and on the side there, again this will be clearer later, the olive, the sprig of olive, the plant which Athena gave to Athens, and upon the oil of which much of Athenian prosperity was based. But this is probably the earliest, one of the earliest owls we have. It must date from about 520. And very soon, the type develops and tends to become more standardized. Here is a very pleasing example. We might guess that it was about 510 or 500 BC, with the head of Athena in fine archaic style, her hair done in neat little ringlets with a pellet in the middle of each. And on the reverse, we now see clearly the owl, the inscription, and the sprig of olive. In contrast to the Vappenmünzen which we saw earlier, these owls were now produced in very great quantities. They are obviously Athenian in every respect, and they traveled abroad all over the Mediterranean. Large numbers have been found in Sicily and in South Italy, in Asia Minor, in the Levant, and in Egypt. They were, from the moment of their inception, traded abroad in presumably to pay for things like timber for the Athenian fleet or for luxuries which could only come from the Near East. Large as this coinage is, it's, or because perhaps it's so large, its style is not constant, and the two pieces you have seen so far are fine examples of archaic Greek art. But I imagine that the number of competent engravers was simply not sufficient to meet the output of dyes required for a vast coinage nourished, as I've said, from the silver mines of Laurium. If you look at the three on the screen here, one can see that the first two are reasonably elegant productions, though there is a tendency always for the flan to be too small. The crest of Athena's helmet gets lost. The owl obviously could do with a larger space here. But nevertheless, the first two are quite nice pieces of archaic art. The third one, of course, is, one might almost say barbarous. It's a very clumsy and crude production. But it seemed likely, from the evidence of hoards, that these very rough coins come not at the beginning, as one might expect, as primitive and experimental, but right at the end of the series. And it looks as though there was some crisis, as indeed there was, of the Persian Wars, when Athens, of course, was captured by the Persians, her buildings thrown down, and the Athenians had to evacuate the city. It may be that these very rough pieces were coined in that crisis, perhaps outside Athens. But it was these owls coming from the exploitation of the mines of Laurium that enabled Athens to build that large fleet in the late 480s, which was the core of the Athenian fleet, core of the Greek fleet, which defeated the Persians decisively at the Battle of Salamis in 480. Now, as I've said, Athens as a city was then destroyed. The Athenians had had to leave it. They came back after the Persian defeat, and they started to rebuild the city, rebuild their temples, and presumably to work their mines once again, and to build up a stock of coinage, a stock of metal with which to renew their coinage. And it seems to have been at this time that the designs of the coins were modernized. The themes weren't changed, but we see that certain changes are made in detail. For example, there is added to Athena's helmet a kind of metal diadem, you could call it, with olive leaves, three olive leaves standing upright on it. This is reasonably interpreted, I think, as a sign of victory perhaps over the Persians in general. A wreath often is, or it's often carried by Nike or victory as one of her attributes. On the reverse, the only addition is a little crescent, a lunar crescent. Sometimes people have tried to extract a date from this, but I think probably there's nothing more in this than an indication that the owl is a lunar bird, and it just shows you that there is the owl, and so it's night time, and so you put in a moon. I doubt if you can get more significance out of it than that. Well, this coinage of this type initiated the Athenian coinage of the 5th century, that great period of Athens when the great buildings of the Acropolis, the Theseum, the period of Pericles, and all that. This is the coinage of the 5th century, starting immediately after the defeat of the Persians in 480, 479. Very soon after this, we get two quite exceptional denominations which appear at no other time in Athenian coinage. The coins we've been looking at were 4 drachma pieces. They weigh about 17 grams. But for a very brief period, we get the coin on the screen, which is a 10-drachma piece, 2.5 times as big. Now, it's a bit of a problem why, just at this one moment in Athenian history, a 10-drachma piece should occur. You see, it has a slight variation that the owl is shown facing. I imagine this shows the owl with its wings spread about to take off, but there has been some rather elaborate suggestion, which I can't myself evaluate, that the owl is doing some sort of mating dance. But why it should do a mating dance and how that helps to explain the coin, I can't see. These decadrams are probably a sign that there was an exceptional amount of bullion to be turned into silver, and modern research associates them with the booty brought back by the Athenian general Cimon from the great battle in which he defeated the Persians at the mouth of the Eurymedon River in southern Asia Minor. The booty was very great, apparently, and the date of these coins, so far as one can judge from the sequence, the whole sequence, does suggest that they are to be dated about 467, the time of the Eurymedon battle. I might just note in passing, I'm often asked, why is this gash here, which of course is reflected on the reverse by the crack there. This very often happens to Greek coins when they have passed out of the economic area in which they were issued. This coin probably passed into the Persian Empire. It was unfamiliar because of its size, and the suspicious locals wondered really whether this was a genuine piece of silver all the way through. So they just drove a chisel into it to determine that the silver went right through and that it wasn't a plated coin with copper in the center and a kind of silver skin over it, which was a perfectly, quite a common method of deception. At about the same time, there's another mysterious denomination. the 2-drachma piece. This was never coined at any other time throughout the history of Athens, or at least throughout the owl coinage. And we simply don't know why at this one period, perhaps for a few years, they decided to mint 2-drachma pieces. Again, you see the slight variation in design. The owl is shown in a sort of little square frame, almost as though it was standing on a windowsill, and the olive sprig hangs down outside. But this does remain something of a puzzle. Another feature of this 5th century coinage is the very large range of denominations, leaving out the 2 exceptional ones, the decadram, the 10-drachma, and the 2-drachma, which you've just seen. The normal coinage consisted of the 4-drachma piece, the 1-drachma, the 1/2-drachma, or 3 obols, the 2-obol piece with the 2 owls, the 1-obol, the 1/2-obol, and you could go on and have 1/4 obol and 1/8 obol. And by that time, you have got down to a tiny little piece of silver, really not very much bigger than the head of a pin. But these were silver coins, bronze coins of token value, hadn't yet been devised, and the Athenians evidently went shopping with these minute silver coins, and as we learn from certain passages of Aristophanes, they tended to take them to the market in their mouths, because there's a story in Aristophanes, I know, of course, it's a joke, but it presumably reflects what people did. A character says, "I was in the market, and the herald called out some unpleasant news, and I was so surprised that I swallowed my small change." So they were, anyway, small enough to be carried in the mouth without great discomfort. This coinage, as I say, started about 480 and went on through the 5th century. But in this time, though there is no actual change of a really noticeable character, the quality of the coinage does rather decline. Not the quality of the metal, not the quality of the weight, but the quality of the artistic engraving. The one on top of the screen here, I should guess, is, you know, near the middle of the century, say 450 to 440. But the one down below, I think one can see that the general quality is becoming a little more slapdash and routine. This perhaps is somewhere near 430. But the interesting thing is, of course, that the Athenians, so far as they could, kept the design unchanged in the formula which had been established about 480. Now, the reason for this, I think, is quite simply that these coins were going abroad in great quantity. We find them in hoards outside Athens rather than in Athens itself. And when I say outside Athens, I don't mean outside in central Greece. I mean outside, as I said, in Anatolia, the Levant, Egypt, central Persia, and even right away over as far as Afghanistan. They were going abroad in payment for imports. Now, in these circumstances, if there was some substantial change in the design, the recipients might feel that this wasn't the right thing, and confidence in this coinage would be undermined. It's very much the same phenomenon as we have or had until recently in Ethiopia and the Red Sea area, where the famous Tala of Maria Theresa, dated 1762, I think that's the right year, but about then, remained current until today, until anyway recent years. These were not, of course, the old Talas minted in Maria Theresa's lifetime. They were, for the most part, exact copies made in London, Paris, Vienna, various mints, in exact imitation, because this had become established as the currency of the area. And if any change had been introduced, confidence in that currency would have been undermined. And I think for exactly the same reason, the Athenians froze the designs of their coinage in the 5th century, so that in the 5th century coinage of Athens, you do not see any reflection of the marvelous changes in sculpture, which, for example, were made public in the sculptures of Parthenon, the Parthenon frieze, and all that. You simply don't get that in the coinage. Now, the fact that these Athenian coins went abroad in quantity, as I have said, was important in itself, because in this way the idea of coinage was introduced abroad. Before I come to that, I should just emphasize that the coins we were last looking at were the sort of coins which paid for the great buildings of 5th century Athens, like the Theseum, which many of you know, and like the Parthenon itself. These rather unattractive, well, not unattractive, but rather unprogressive coins, archaic coins, were what was financing the great sculptural advances of the Parthenon in its frieze and in its pedimental sculptures. But as I say, these coins also went abroad, and naturally one finds reflections of this in the Near East, in areas where coinage was perhaps only just beginning. This is one of the earliest coins of Tyre in Phoenicia, and I suppose it would be dated about 430. But it's, on the whole, not very like an Athenian coin, but the idea that on the reverse of it you have an owl-like bird, admittedly this is Egyptian, it's a horned owl, I think it's called, carrying the Egyptian symbols of sovereignty, the crook and the flail. But the idea that you put that sort of thing on the reverse of a coin is surely inspired from the coinage of Athens. One could quote other examples of this, but the critical moment, I think, is probably the outbreak of the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta and her allies in 431, because from then onwards, the flow of silver owls out of Attica abroad was interrupted, because Athens now needed all her resources for the war at home, to buy timber for her fleet and that kind of thing. So it does seem that in the Near East a shortage of owls manifested itself, and some enterprising characters attempted to make good this shortage. Now, this rather inelegant object on the screen, you will recognize perhaps that this is a head of Athena. The helmet, of course, is right off plan, and that rather scrawny object is Athena's owl, and somebody has attempted to copy the inscription, and also to copy the sprig of olive. In other words, they had become so familiar with owls that when the supply dried up, locals attempted to make good the supply by copying them, because the area, and this is Syria, the area had no coinage of its own yet, and the only sort of coinage they knew about was Athenian coinage. But not all copies at this time were equally incompetent. Here is another one. You recognize at once the owl, the little crescent, the sprig of olive. But when you look for the inscription Athenion, instead you see the letters, Greek letters, B, A, S. This can only be an abbreviation for Basileios of the king, and the only king in question can be the king of Persia. Turning this coin over, one gets something of a surprise on the other side, because instead of the expected head of Athena, you get a remarkable portrait, perhaps the first portrait on any coin. A portrait, a fine bearded head of a Persian satrap wearing the distinctive headdress of the Persian nobility. In all probability, this is the great Persian satrap Tissaphernes, who was in charge of much of Asia Minor for the Persian king during the last 10 years of the 5th century. He appears prominently in Thucydides, sometimes flirting with the Athenians under Alcibiades, but finally putting his resources behind the Spartan fleet in an attempt to overthrow Athenian control of the Aegean. So we see that even Athens' enemies had to imitate, or you might almost say pervert, the coins of Athens in order to fight against her. This coin, which is still unique, was in fact found in a hoard of ordinary Athenian coins, and it was only when it came to be cleaned that its remarkable character was recognized. Now, Athens had started the Peloponnesian War with ample resources. Pericles had had great foresight. He'd laid aside reserve funds of 1,000 talents only to be used in an emergency. But the emergency eventually came. With the disastrous failure of the expedition against Syracuse, most of the allies revolted. The Spartans established a fortress, a Decalia, in Attica itself, so cutting off communication with the mines. And by 406 BC, Athens really ran out of silver. There was virtually none left, and there was none coming in, either from the mines or in tribute. In this emergency, since the war had to go on, since fleets still had to be built, timber had to be imported, Athens, as an emergency measure, resorted to a gold coinage. There were still gold ornaments, gold dedications, gold figures of victory on the Acropolis, and some of these were melted down in 406 to produce an emergency gold coinage, modeled, as you see, on the silver coinage. This is a gold dioble, just with two owls, just as the silver dioble had two owls, and so on. And this coinage enabled Athens to continue the war for a few more years until the Spartans finally closed in 404, besieged the city of Athens, and eventually captured it. A good deal of political upheaval followed, but eventually things settled down. Athens became independent again in the early 4th century. The mines were reopened and a new coinage started. The new coinage was very much the same as the old. On the screen we've got the 5th century owl, the 4th century owl, and on the right a late 4th century, perhaps even early 3rd century owl. We, lining them up, looking for differences, can see that there is some change. Athena becoming much more sort of feminine looking. The archaic caste of the 5th century owl is finally abandoned. The owl becomes progressively more wild and frenetic until at last it becomes just a sort of series of dots and dashes. But I'm sure to the people at the time, they didn't see this. They thought that they were simply continuing the coinage on the model of the past. And indeed, as the 4th century went on, the ravages of the Peloponnesian War were made good. Even some of the gold victories, which had been melted down, were replaced on the Acropolis. The silver coinage built up to a great quantity and was exported in the way that it had been in the 5th century. And as in the 5th century, we find imitations, though these imitative coins are now confined largely to Egypt, because in the meantime, the rest of the Levant, particularly Phoenicia, Palestine, had developed its own coinage, so that I think Athenian owls entering the country were probably melted down to provide the local coinage. But Egypt still lacked any native coinage, any locally struck coinage, and there the idea of what a coin should be was still the Athenian tetradrachm. Here, as you see, is a gold coin, but clearly imitated from the normal head of Athena on the silver tetradrachm. If we look at the reverse of this coin, it has an owl, sure enough, as we would expect, but instead of the sprig of olive, it has, appropriately for Egypt, a papyrus plant. And instead of the name of the Athenians, there is another name, T-A-O, and probably an S off the flan, Tachos. Now, we know from our literary sources that Tachos was an ephemeral pharaoh, native Egyptian, who joined a great revolt of the satraps against the Persian king in 362. He had a very brief and undistinguished career, but in the course of it, he had to pay some mercenaries, and he coined some gold coins, like the one on the screen, on the weight of a Persian derrick to pay his troops. And once again, the only idea he had of what a coin should look like was an Athenian tetradrachm, so he adapted it to his purposes. One more example of this kind of thing, again from Egypt, now a much better produced coin, the familiar head of Athena, the owl, and all the rest, but instead of the name of Athens, once again you have an inscription in Aramaic. And there's more than one class of these coins. they give the name of the Persian satraps ruling in Egypt just before the arrival of Alexander in 2 or 3, I forget which year. I think he got to Egypt in 332. And this gives the name, in fact, of the satrap Sabaces, who was, in fact, killed at the Battle of Issus. He left Egypt to support Darius and was killed at Issus. Another class of these coins gives a different name, Madzarkes, who surrendered, the satrap who surrendered Egypt to Alexander. So right down to near the end of the 4th century, in Egypt, the only idea, really, of what a coin should look like was an Athenian tetragram. But, of course, Alexander founded Alexandria, established a mint there, which then started producing local tetragrams on the typical Alexandrian type. Now, we've got down to about the end of the 4th century. The 3rd century in Athens was a rather bleak and dim period. Athens lost her political independence to Macedonia, and for most of the century appears to have been incorporated into the kingdom of Macedonia. We don't know exactly when Athenian type coinage stopped. There may have been small issues in the 3rd century which have not yet been identified, but probably the output of the mines simply went to Macedonia and was converted into the coinage of the Macedonian kings. Athens, of course, remained a place of some importance, both as a trading center and both as a kind of university city. But by the end of the century, by the end of the 3rd century, things were changing because the whole balance of Greek politics was changed by the gradual intervention of a power from the west, Rome. From about 220, Rome was becoming involved, progressively involved, in the affairs of Greece, and particularly becoming involved with the local great power, the kings of Macedonia. But Athens sided with Rome. In 229, she recovered her independence and was favorably looked on by Rome and indeed by various Hellenistic kings of the period, who gave Athens monumental buildings like the Stoa of Attalos, the Attalos II, king of Pergamum, who gave this building, now restored, of course, as the museum to display the finds made in the extensive American excavations of the Agora. It was in the 2nd century that the last great coinage of Athens came about. One has to approach this rather cautiously. The Roman general Flamininus, after having defeated Philip V of Macedon at Kynos Cephalae in 196, he then declared all the cities of Greece free. This would be an appropriate moment for a resumption of coinage, but I suspect it was perhaps 20 or so years later. Opinion seems to be veering towards about 175, when the Athenian coinage started again, as you can see, on a new pattern, but one which maintained the old themes, the head of Athena and the owl. But now the head of Athena is much more elaborate. She's wearing a triple-crested helmet. There is, I think it's a Pegasus, a winged horse, on the side of the helmet, and there are a row of four parts of horses along the front. And this seems to be a version, if not an exact copy, a version of the great statue of Athena by Phidias, which stood within the Parthenon. On the reverse, the owl now stands upon an amphora, symbolizing the olive oil, which was exported in such quantity, and the design is surrounded by a wreath. This wreath seems to be a matter of fashion. A lot of coinages, a lot of places in the early 2nd century seem to have adopted designs where the main type, here the owl, was surrounded by a wreath. And indeed, in inventories and inscribed accounts and that kind of thing, these coins are called Stephaniforoi, wreath bearers, to distinguish them from the older owl coinage, which we've been looking at up to now, which were called Glaucophoroi, owl bearers. You also notice perhaps that the flan on which the coins are struck are now much thinner and more spread than they had been up to now. This new coinage, this is traditionally known as the new style coinage of Athens. That's the modern term, new style, to distinguish it from the older owls. This came to be produced in great quantities. Many hoards have been found throughout mainland Greece, in Macedonia, and particularly on the island of Delos. In 166, Rome gave the island of Delos, which is one of the Aegean islands. Many of you have no doubt visited Delos if you've been to Greece. Rome gave the island of Delos to Athens to become a free port. This apparently was a measure taken against Rhodes, the island of Rhodes, which had been anti-Roman, and in order to attract trade and so on from Rhodes, Delos was made a free port and became a major centre of commerce and trade, lying between the Roman-influenced mainland of Greece to the west and the Hellenistic kingdoms to the east. It obviously was a kind of mushroom growth. You can see the houses of the rich merchants of Delos climbing up the slopes. Each of the houses has its sort of status symbol, marble columns. Many of them seem to have been set up so quickly that they didn't even have time to provide the normal flutings on the columns. Elsewhere, you in Delos, you have buildings set up by associations of Italian merchants or associations of merchants from the East Mediterranean. And one can imagine these new style coins, they were the main currency of this trading area. I have even been fortunate enough myself in walking along one of the roads of Delos to pick up a silver, not a tetradrachm, but a silver drachma of exactly this period lying between the stones. This coinage, as I say, was produced in great quantity. The earlier pieces, of which you saw one just now, are rather attractive. Later, they become less attractive, but they also become crowded with information. The owl, as we've said, on the amphora, standing on the amphora, is the main type. The wreath around, mostly off the flan. The name, Athens, I'm afraid I know what has happened here. This slide was so dusty this morning that I took it to pieces, took the picture out, and I've now put the reverses in back to front. So really you should mentally reverse the back. But the name Athens, Athy up the top, we then get a string of names, usually two or three, Eumerides and Alcidamo, and the beginning of another one, B-O-I. On the amphora, you see there's a letter alpha in that case. That one ought also to have a letter, but it's not clear. There are 13, the first 13 letters of the Greek alphabet occur on these, in this position, and these are clearly the months in which the particular issue of coin was put out. Because the Greek year had 12 months and the 13th intercalary month, so you can get up to 13 letters. There are also letter groups down here in each case, and these are thought, though it's not certain, these may indicate the mines, or the particular mines, from which the particular batch of silver came. In addition, there is a major symbol here, in this case Triptolemus in a car drawn by serpents, in that case a griffin. Now, in this case, down here, the griffin is quite interesting because the man named on this coin is Apellicon. And we know there was, at this date in Athens, a philosopher of some repute called Apellicon. Well, you might say, well, why should the two be the same? Why should the Apellicon on the coin have anything to do with the known philosopher? The reason is that we know Apellicon came from the island of Chios, and the badge which you get on the coins of the island of Chios is a griffin. So this is, certainly as we as can be, is the same Apellicon known from literature, who evidently at some stage was in charge of the Athenian mint for a brief period. Altogether, some 600 names of Athenians are known from this series of coins, and many of these names can be tied up with well-known Athenian families. Towards the end of this coinage, we have a remarkable gold issue. The designs in general are the same, but what is remarkable about it is the inscription which says Basile Mithridates, and then a second name, Aristion. King Mithridates, this is the great Mithridates VI, king of Pontus. He had, as you know, come into conflict with Rome, and Athens at this stage, early in the 1st century BC, foolishly gave up her Roman affiliation and sided with Mithridates, and Mithridates evidently
provided a subsidy in gold to support his interests in Athens. The second name, Aristion, he is known to have held, a man of that name is known to have held Athens on behalf of Mithridates. The upshot of this, of course, was unfortunate for Athens, because the Roman general Sulla, leading the war for the Roman side against Mithridates, captured and sacked Athens in the year 87-86 BC. This was not the end of Athens or of a new style coinage. This went on probably until about 50 BC. But like the previous coinages of Athens, this new style coinage also stimulated imitations or copies like the coin on the screen. You'll see exactly the same designs: the head of Athena, the owl on the amphora, the wreath, but there is no name Athens on it. Instead of the name of the city, there are two monograms which have been resolved as the name Marcos, M-A-R there, and T-A-M on that side. Now, T-A-M could be the abbreviation of Tamias, which is the Greek word used to translate the Roman quaestor. The Roman quaestor was the financial official in charge of the pay of Roman armies, and it is thought that this coin represents Marcus Lucullus, quaestor of Sulla. In other words, these are coins struck in imitation of the local coinage of Athens to fund, to supply, to pay the Roman army. The Romans tended at this period of the Republic not to bring in their own coinage, but to mint coins which fitted in with the area in which they were fighting. And so we see here the Roman equivalent, the Roman army's pay, fitting in, intended to circulate beside the coinage of Athens, the main coinage of the area. A similar example is seen here, again, obviously based on the coins of Athens, the owl and the amphora, but instead of the name of Athens, you have an inscription saying Gortuneon and a bull. Well, that is of the people of Gortina in Crete. This coin does not stand alone. There are about seven Cretan cities which produced coins of this type, with their appropriate inscription, Knossion, Gortunion, and others. And here again, these are obviously intended to fit in with the coinage of Athens. And the occasion seems to be, once again, around about 87, Sulla, needing to build up support, needing to recruit a fleet, sent Lucullus to Crete, and Lucullus brought over the Cretan cities to the Roman side. And as to show their loyalty, they were obviously requested, or perhaps ordered, to provide subsidies. And they minted their subsidies in a type of coin not usual to the Cretan cities, but one which would fit in with the needs of Roman armies operating on the basis of the Athenian tetragram. The last group of imitations is odder still. You might say, what have these got to do with Athens? But if you look there, you will see our old friend the owl standing on a now rather diminutive and shrunken amphora, and you will even see there the remains of the inscription Alpha Theta Epsilon. The rest is all a bit strange, and this is the script used in Arabia. And these imitations come from Arabia. The precise date of the first one, I can't be sure, but it must be the first century BC. The local tribes there had seen these Athenian owls and again had copied them. And here we come on to more familiar ground. The inscription Athens is gone. We still find the owl and the amphora. And here, I think unmistakably, is a head of the Emperor Augustus wearing a wreath, wearing a laurel wreath. And Augustus, of course, mounted an invasion of Arabia in, I think, 24 BC, if I remember right. So here is the tail end of the coinage of Athens. At Athens itself, by the time of Augustus, the coinage had indeed ceased. In the middle of the 5th century BC, at about the time when the famous Tower of the Winds was erected as the local town clock, water clock of Athens, it seems that at last this long train of Athenian silver coinage had come to an end. I suppose there are a number of reasons for this. The Athens had lost any political significance, a university city, if you like. She was probably no longer even a major port. The Roman denarius was now becoming the world currency. But more important than any of these, at long last, as Strabo tells us, the mines which had produced this steady flow of silver for so many centuries were becoming exhausted, at least to the resources of ancient technology. And the great coinage of Athens at last dries up. This wasn't in any sense, of course, the end of Athens. She went on as a major city in the Roman Empire, honored by Roman emperors, by Hadrian, for example, who at last completed the great temple of Olympian Zeus, started 5 centuries before by Pisistratus. But there was no more silver coinage except a local, no silver coinage, only a local issue of bronze. We can, I think, perhaps end at more or less the point where we started. Standing on the Acropolis of Athens, looking out northwards over the civic center of Athens, known as the Agora, with the Stoa of Athens on one side and the Theseum on the other. Down in this corner, in this area, near a little Byzantine church, the excavators found a building which seemed to have been in use over a number of centuries and also seemed to have been a center of metalworking. And in the area of this building, they found quite a lot of blanks, mostly bronze, I think all bronze, blanks, which appeared to be blanks for coinage. So we have some reason for thinking that in this corner of the Agora, was perhaps situated the mint which had produced so many of the coins we have been looking at for the last hour. Thank you very much.
In the tradition of the Institute, Dr. Cray has agreed to answer questions. Please speak clearly and keep your questions short. Yes, sir.
What techniques are used to feed coins out of their phone?
You put me at a disadvantage because perhaps I ought to put my thing on again. Techniques for cleaning Greek coins. You put me at something of an advantage because I'm lucky enough to have in my museum a laboratory to do this. So if a coin needs cleaning, I send it to them and don't ask any questions. clearly, and if I do ask questions, I'm always given the answer, well, each one has to be dealt with on its merits, and you can't lay down any general rules. The cleaning of bronze is going to be a different problem from the cleaning of silver. So you see, frankly, I'm hedging, and I'm afraid I can't really give a sensible answer on this one.
This
is a double question. First, could you deal with the mechanics of the striking of these coins? Would they be done one face at a time? And also, could you give us some ideas to the comparative value of the silver and gold coins at the time?
Well, let's take the first one. You have two dies. The obverse die, in the case of the Athenian coinage, that would be the side with the head on it. That is set in a, as it were, here in a kind of anvil. You prepare blanks, obviously to the right weight, because you're dealing with gold or silver. You put the blank on it. You then have a reverse die, which is a kind of more punch-like thing. You, there may be another man with a hammer, probably a separate man with a hammer, who hammers this down, and it's done in one process like that. That is a one-sentence description of how the job is done. Does that answer you sufficiently? Now, you asked the second question, the relative value of gold and silver. This is something that is going to vary to some extent according to the relative supplies of the local supplies of metal. But roughly, it's in the area of, by weight of 10 or 12 to 1. Gold being 10 or 12 times, you need 10 or 12 grams of silver to value 1 gram of gold. Now, is that what you wanted to know? Yeah, good.
I have two questions. You showed us the pictures of the Athenian tetragrams, many different styles. Could you, A, give us an idea of the buying power of a tetragram in those times? And B, you mentioned the silver coins that people carried in their mouth. What about copper, bronze coins? What was there much in the way of bronze coins struck at that time?
The buying power of ancient coins or ancient Greek coins is always a little difficult. If only we were in Babylonia, say, with a mass of cuneiform tablets giving the price of loads of dates and all that kind of thing, one could give a much more intelligible answer. One very much lacks documents on prices in the Greek world. But, I mean, if this gives you some sort of answer, I could suggest the following. A tetradrachm consists of four drachmae, each of which consists of six obols, so that's 24 obols. Now, Pericles passed a measure ensuring that Athenian citizens who attended the jury courts, and this was part of the legal system, that they had very large courts so that every citizen could take part, so that they didn't lose on this, he instituted a payment of two obols a day, so that one might suppose that two obols was the normal sort of rate of subsistence of an ordinary Athenian per day. So your tetradrachm is getting on for a fortnight's pay for an ordinary citizen. I think probably that's the best I can do on this one. Now, I'm sorry, what was the second part of
the second one was, you were mentioning about the tiny little silver coin.
Yes.
What about bronze?
Bronze, yes. At the time I was talking about, the later 5th century, and indeed well into the 4th century, Athens and many other places had no bronze coinage. This seems to have been thought of first in Sicily, perhaps around the middle of the 5th century, then spread to places in South Italy, and then on into mainland Greece during the 4th century. I think Athens had such a tradition of using pure silver that, inconvenient as it was, no bronze coins of Athens are known before about the middle of the 4th century. Now, this does create a problem, because however small you made your bit of silver, it was going to still be, I think, too valuable for the lowest possible purchases. I mean, the half dozen eggs, a cabbage, this kind of thing. Even a quarter of an obol would be too valuable for that purpose. So it does create a bit of a problem as to what they used for the lower pieces. And beyond saying that there are mysterious references to things called koluboi in the authors, which seem to be very small coins of perhaps something like lead or base metal, unofficial, I think, probably, rather than official products of the mint. It's either those or barter. I mean, you knew your shopkeeper so well that you carried things over until you had an obol's worth and you paid something of that sort.
Yes.
This is the origin of coinage, the date of the earliest coins. The earliest coins that we know of come from Asia Minor and are probably to be dated in the latter part of the 7th century, about 625, 600. They were made of electrum, which was a natural mixture, natural alloy of gold and silver, which was later made artificially, though in the first place it seems to have been found locally by panning from local rivers. The first person to abandon this system of electrum, of which the weakness is that you can't tell precisely what is in it. Whether, I mean, it makes quite a difference to the intrinsic value if there's going to be 10% more or less of gold in it, for example. And so it has a certain disadvantage for international trade. Seems to, the first person to abandon this seems to have been King Croesus of Lydia, reigning from about 560 to 545, and he instituted, related, a bimetallic system of pure gold and pure silver. And this was then taken over by the Persians when they conquered Lydia, and also was taken up in mainland Greece, where silver was available, but not electrum or gold. I'm talking of a Greek context. I don't believe, though I'm subject to correction, that the Chinese had gold or silver coins at this sort of date. I've never come across any.
Do you have any idea what they used in the 1000
years? China is not my field, I'm afraid. I think I won't risk that one.
Yes.
Yes.
However, my question is this. I presume that a great deal of the coinage that is on the markets of the Western world of that period is counterfeit. Is that correct when you say?
Yes. Counterfeits are always a hazard. To what extent most of the coins on the market are counterfeit, I think, rather depends on what sort of market you go to, perhaps. I think reputable dealers would not, except by mistake, have counterfeits. But I do agree that there are a lot of counterfeits about. These are a hazard. And, of course, the technique of producing them is from time to time improved. I mean, once the defects of a particular vintage are spotted, then the counterfeiters go away and think how to overcome those particular defects. But there is nonetheless a very good supply of perfectly genuine coins available if you feel you are rich enough to buy them. They do tend to become rather expensive, and more so as the years go by, I'm afraid. What you bought in Afghanistan, I'm afraid I can't tell. There have been notorious groups of forgeries from that area, but of course there are also some perfectly genuine coins from that area too.
Yes. With all the information on the coins, it's rather interesting to see there's no information of the value of the coin itself, the denomination. How did people know it is 4 or 2 or whatever?
Yes, this is true. There is very rarely explicit information on the coin. Though I think it very often happens that where two denominations are fairly close together, you get a different reverse type. There's something in the reverse. Like, for example, the diobol had 2 owls on it to show it was a 2-obol piece. The 3-obol piece had a facing owl with 2 sprigs of olive. The drachma had the ordinary owl. And when you, the difference between, I mean, 1 drachma and 4 drachma is so great in weight that you don't really need there to distinguish the types. So I think there are quite often subtle means that the users would have known to distinguish between denominations. If I give you one more example of that, at Syracuse, where the main type is a four-horse chariot, the tetradrachm has a chariot with four horses. The two-drachma piece has a man on a horse leading a second horse, two horses. The one-drachma piece has a man on a horse. Going smaller still, you might have just the head of a horse, you see, and so on. This happens.
Yes.
When? I mean, this must have fluctuated at different times.
Did they tend to hold coins in number, or was it more
bullion? Well, Delphi, of course, were being an international center. All sorts of people came in from different places, bringing all sorts of different coins of different weights, different purity. Some of these were certainly held in temples, and in some cases one has temple inventories carrying forward the amounts that the officials took over each year and handed on to their successors. But in the case of Delphi, we know at least that in 336 they decided to melt down all the miscellaneous coins in their treasury and convert it into a local Delphic coinage. But whether we have any idea, if we do, I don't have it in my head, of the sort of total weight of coinage then converted, I can't tell you, I'm afraid.
There's a lady, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Well, no. I'm afraid I haven't brought a tetradrachm with me. I don't know if anyone has, but an Athenian tetradrachm is roughly the same weight of metal as the old English half crown. Now, I mean, if that gives you, I mean, I know I'm not in England, but I can't.
Half
dollar, I'm told, is about the same size as a half dollar. Well, you're all right. And the other question you asked me was about the relative value and the metal and so on. These coins are all struck in silver and or gold, as the case may be, but very pure as they knew technologically how to make it. And so each denomination is in precise weight relation with the other one. I mean, the drachma will weigh, or should weigh, I mean, when it was minted, exactly quarter of the tetradrachm, and so on all the way down. So that the value, the purchasing power or value of the coin does depend very precisely on the amount of precious metal in it. And this was regulated very precisely over the different denominations.
Yes.
How and why did you become a numismatist?
Well, I think this is partly inheritance, partly chance. I think from an early age I was always interested in archaeology, and the fact that I have ended up in charge of a major collection must be partly good luck, also interest. But I perhaps should say that I think an interest in numismatics was implanted from an early age, Because my grandfather was a sculptor, and he was also responsible for designing coins. He, in fact, designed the head of King George V on the Canadian, British, and other imperial coinages of the period. So from quite an early age, I was sort of introduced to aspects of coinage other than their practical uses. But whether that is, whether a psychologist would give another answer to that, I don't know.
Yes. Yes, sir.
I suppose this may have happened in some places, but in the case of Athens, the Attic standard of about 17.2 grams for the tetradrachm and subdivisions, of course, pro rata, this remained absolutely constant, as far as I can see, for about 500 years. And also over an area from Athens as far as northwest India, or back to, say, Afghanistan again. The standard doesn't seem to have been significantly altered over a very long period. elsewhere, I think you could find cases where, in an emergency, a certain amount of copper might have been mixed in with the silver, but this is very rare and was usually avoided as much as possible, I think.
Gentleman in the back.
The coins of Alexander classified as Roman or Greek.
Sorry, again?
The coins of Alexander.
On behalf of Alexander the Great, were they Greek or Roman?
Greek. Greek, because Alexander the Great, became king in 336 and he died in 323. At that time, I think Rome didn't have any coinage at all. Roman coinage simply had not started then. So Alexander the Great is definitely Greek. An eagle
landing on the
coins of Alexander the Great. These would be of silver as pure as they knew how to make it, just like the others. Yeah.
Just two more, I think, yes. This gentleman. Yes, go ahead.
On the Athenian issues of the 2nd century, did they maintain a consistent quality of silver content, or did they eventually become more villain as time came along?
Oh, no, definitely not. The silver was maintained throughout, so far as I know. I'm not sure how many of these have been analyzed, but I have no reason to think that right to the end of Athenian silver coinage, I don't think the quality was ever significantly reduced.
Yes.
A circular earring.
Yeah. Is that an earring?
Yeah, an earring, presumably going through the lobe of the ear. You do get other types of, not at Athens, but elsewhere, you get other types of earrings, sometimes or pendant ones, but she is always shown with a circular earring, and I suppose that is the form of the earring which was on the cult statue of Athena in the Parthenon.
I'd like to ask Dr. Anthony would like the head of the Department of Classics at UBC to thank Dr. Craig.
I think you would. I think you would all agree, ladies and gentlemen, that it's rare that we have the opportunity to hear a man of such learning who wears it both so lightly and so excessively, who can make what could have been quite a recondite and perhaps even a dull subject come to life for us. His approach is perhaps unique. He obviously brings great love of his subject, which he communicates to us palpably in his talks. The relatively humble coinage which we're used to has been made to yield up a good deal of information. So if I could adapt the title of a well-known book, I could say that Dr. Cray has made the Greek coins speak to us tonight, speak eloquently and informatively, but above all, very, very attractively and memorably. And I hope you will all join me in thanking him for his very splendid performance this evening.
We look forward to seeing you next week when Dr. Brian Pate, the Assistant Director of Triumph, will speak on a radiochemist's view of a brain at work. Till next week.